Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hey folks, you love us, and I hope you love Amazon. I'm a customer. Well, here's a great way to shop at Amazon while supporting Wolfpot. Instead of going directly to Amazon, go to wolfpot.com/Amazon. That'll take you to the same Amazon you know and love, and all the prices will be the same as they always are, but we'll get a sweet, sweet kickback, and that helps everybody. You, me, Baron, everybody here. Give it a try. wolfpot.com/Amazon, and we thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin, and this is Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn. Without Baron Vaughn today, sitting in, filling in, marking time, propping things up, is my daughter, Jessie Maltin.
I'm a great propper-upper.
You are.
Thank you.
You do that well.
Thanks, Daddy.
And here we are for another week of conversation about movies. And including your questions, which you have sent in great number, great volume. And we're going to focus a little bit on one topic today, being music in film. But we'll cover some other ground, too. And how'd the music theme come up, Jess?
Well, quite simply, something that happens a lot is people will ask me, most of my life consists of talking about this guy over here. I have to call home a lot and ask questions because people just want to ask me what he thinks about things. So I think really now we're almost as one. We are as one. But something that a lot of folks don't know, we've talked about this a bit on the podcast, but my dad is a really overall music nut, specifically though jazz nut, knows his jazz backwards and forwards, participates in the LA Jazz Society, hosts their dinners. And so for me, I actually fell in love with jazz because of him and became a jazz singer. And because of his and my mother's love of musicals, because they were both in – they both grew up, you know, my dad just outside of New York City, my mom in New York City. They both got to see – my mother in particular. My mother saw Ethel Merman in Gypsy, Yul Brynner – in The King and I. I mean, she really got to have some phenomenal experiences. So music is a very big part of our lives.
Yes.
And it's something that we, as collectively, my dad plays the piano, loves to play the piano, and his ukulele.
I wish I were better.
I know. He tries hard, though, but he does. He has a ukulele. My mom loves to sing. I sing and used to play the piano and the accordion. Why? Because Jackie Maltin, mother of Leonard Maltin, who has since passed, she played the accordion and told me that I would be cool if I could play the accordion. I don't think she realized hipsters would make that real, but my entire childhood when I went, yeah, I play the accordion, and kids went, you're weird.
But we move on.
We move on. Do we? No. Sometimes we cry at night. From last week, so many good questions. One of them being from Chris Jones, what, in your opinion, is the best movie score? What about the most effective? And doesn't have to be the same.
Well, that's an impossible question to answer. First off, it's totally subjective.
Yeah.
What your taste is, what you happen to like. And there's so many different kinds of scores. And of course, now there really are so many different kinds of scores.
Yeah.
There's traditional orchestral scores. There's electronic scores, entirely synthesized scores. There are entire source music scores, which didn't used to exist. See, if you grew up watching movies in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and even into the 60s, well into the 60s, the only music you tended to hear was an orchestral music score composed by a film composer. And on the big Hollywood movies, they were very European influenced. People like Max Steiner and Franz Waxman actually came from Europe and brought their Eric Wolfgang Korngold, all of these giants of that time. They brought their education and their background with them and gradually morphed those into an American style that was a hybrid. But that's the kind of music you grew up hearing. And then a little movie came along called American Graffiti, where George Lucas designed the movie around top 40 songs of the period in the 60s that he was evoking in that film. And not only did the film become a huge hit, but so did the soundtrack. It revived a lot of that music. It introduced it to a new generation. And it also ushered in a new era in films and film scoring.
The soundtrack.
The soundtrack, exactly. And the soundtrack has its, you know, good points and its bad points. Sometimes I find them too contrived.
Mm-hmm.
They exist for commercial reasons only. Somebody wants to sell, now it's stream or downloads, but at one time it was to sell albums or to sell CDs. And was that really the best or most appropriate kind of song to use in a film? Or was it just an excuse to get a track that could get played and call attention to the movie? But there are no rules anymore.
Mm-mm.
Whatever works, works. Just when it seemed like the source music score was dominant and the orchestral score was gone, along came the 70s and John Williams. And John Williams started, he has a long career. He was playing piano on studio dates in the 50s and did a lot of recordings and a lot of arrangements for pop music people, and then eventually started scoring films, I think, in the early 60s. And I like some of his early scores, too, for not very significant films like Penelope and Not With My Wife You Don't. I mean, there are early scores that have been reissued that are fun to listen to, very much of their time. But then both Mr. Spielberg and Mr. Lucas and some others called on him and tried to – you can't picture Jaws without his music. You can't envision Star Wars without his music. You wouldn't want to see Superman, the original Christopher Reeve Superman, without his theme. The Indiana Jones films without those themes. John Williams has written the soundtrack of our lives for decades.
The word prolific gets thrown around a lot, but
And he's more versatile. Sometimes snarky people will want to put him down as being too establishment, you know?
Hmm.
Well, listen again. I mean, when Spielberg did Catch Me If You Can, there's a very whimsical animated opening title sequence. And Williams wrote a whimsical score for that is as good as anything he's ever done and as far afield from the Superman march or something like that,
yeah,
as you can imagine. He's a brilliant, brilliant composer.
And we were talking about this last night. We were saying how it's incredible. I brought up I was talking about John Williams. I had said to three of my friends in Manchester who are music nuts, I said to them, all right, guys, we're going to be doing a music episode. Do you have a good question? And they said, well, what do you think are the best soundtracks? Let me say, Lee, Mark, and Ben asked me. They said, what do you think are the best soundtracks? And in that question, I said, well, do you mean orchestral or do you mean soundtrack? And that got us all started talking about John Williams,
right,
saying that it's an incredible thing that a man could have written so many.
Oh, we didn't mention E.T. We didn't mention E.T., the extraterrestrial.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible. Yeah, just
– It doesn't end.
It doesn't end. It doesn't – it's Harry Potter too, right?
Oh yeah, he did a lot of those.
Yeah, he did a lot of the Harry Potter. I mean, it's honestly jaw dropping to think about. Mm-hmm. It's jaws dropping. We were talking about this, and I said to my dad how incredible it is to me that Jaws is two notes, and from those two notes,
two notes repeated.
From those two notes, you hear it used all the time. Whether it's meant to be funny or scary, if a camera is coming up in the water towards someone swimming, you hear da-da, da-da, or something in that family.
Mm-hmm.
What my dad mentioned, though,
the predecessor
was the original.
Was Bernard Herrmann's shrieking violins when Janet Leigh gets murdered in the shower in Psycho. those shrieking violins became almost a cliche.
Yep.
Still called upon.
Yep.
Both realistically and often for parody, you know, for comedy purposes. But nevertheless, it's like the Jaws cue. It just stands alone. People who don't even know where it came from recognize it.
Yeah.
And it symbolizes something. It says, this is scary. This is murder. This is, you know, something grim or grisly. And there haven't been many like that. You know, one score that struck me and has never left my mind is Thomas Newman's score for American Beauty.
Mm, yeah.
The movie starts, if I remember correctly, with an overhead shot. It's like a helicopter shot of a suburban sprawl.
Mm-hmm.
And you're about to, you know, go down and visit this house and meet Kevin Spacey's character and Annette Bening and everybody else. But he composed an opening cue using marimbas that just told you something was not right. This may be suburbia, but something is out of whack here, off kilter. And he establishes that in the first 10 seconds of the movie. He does it.
Mm-hmm.
Not the director, no discredit to the director or the writer or the actors. It's Thomas Newman doing that. And that's been imitated quite a lot too.
And it's incredible when you start to think about these things. It's really something. And speaking about film soundtracks, again, The Boys, the two that they came up with were Cruel Intentions and Trainspotting. I tend to go more for sort of, I know we've actually spoken a lot, on this show at this point about Almost Famous. But what certain films are able to do is, sort of act as an education musically. So for people who don't know Simon and Garfunkel, for people who don't know all the people, because it is an incredible soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
You now have this one CD, or pardon me now, iTunes, whatever you have, that can give you a little bit of education.
Right.
And this I find often when we watch movies that are meant to be at a specific time during a specific time.
Look at the incredible impact that T-Bone Burnett's score for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou had.
Incredible.
I mean it launched an entire mini industry for a while.
Yep.
Of back to the roots and bluegrass music.
Well, that's what the first time my dad said to me, "What do you think of Mumford and Sons? And will you play some Mumford and Sons for me?" I said, "Yeah." And you won't believe, because honest to God, had you told me that a band like Mumford and Sons would be as incredibly famous as they are, I would say, "No way. There's no way. It's folk music." Again, you have banjos, you have all these different instruments that don't get played. Oh my God, they're number one. How did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, frankly, a lot of it does come from, even though it's several years ago now, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Mm-hmm. And on that, they had Emmy Lou Harris. They had just, you know, the best of the best. Alison Krauss, who has the voice of an angel. Absolutely incredible stuff.
Right. And then there was that wonderful documentary, The Buena Vista Social Club.
Yeah.
Which introduced a lot of people to Cuban music and sort of spurred a concert series and touring shows and put a lot of people into the American arena, the United States arena, who hadn't been well known or recognized here.
Yeah.
Though, you know, much recognized in their homeland, of course.
Yeah.
So films can have, music in films can have an incredible resonance and can do so much.
Two of the soundtracks that a lot of my friends actually gripe about are Garden State and Juno. Reason being, it took some indie bands that were, you know, I think we the musical folks who love someone from the beginning. When you hear somebody in a small cafe, or if you're in Los Angeles and you go, you know, to the hotel cafe, or, you know, you're in New York, you go to these small venues, and there's so many venues, and you see someone, or in my case, I was in Scotland, and I saw this, you know, I've seen so many just incredible either singer-songwriters, all these folks, when you hear them, there's a little bit of you that kind of loves that you get to keep it for yourself and share it with your friends one by one. And when those people blow up, it can be hard, and it's when it becomes that, well, I'm really excited for you, but I also don't know that I like that everyone has heard of you now.
Yes, well, you want a little exclusivity.
You know, you want to be able to keep them for yourself. And so I have a lot of friends who say that with the Garden State soundtrack specifically, because that was all indie bands. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of friends who are quite angry at that soundtrack in general.
Oh, well.
Oh, well, indeed.
Well, and then you tell me that you've been watching, you've been revisiting a film that I like that we saw together at Sundance called God Help the Girl.
This is, you know, this is one of those movies where we saw it at Sundance together. I liked it. And then afterwards went, why did I like this movie? And was sort of confused.
Well, how can it's a Scottish musical? How can you?
It's
not
a Glaswegian musical.
Yes, it is, very specific.
I mean, really, starring Emily Browning, who's an Aussie, but
written and directed by Stuart Murdoch of the indie band Belle and Sebastian.
He's one of the creators of Belle and Sebastian, and I knew that I really enjoyed the movie when we watched it, and then. It's one of those that I just found all these holes, and I went, well, that doesn't make sense. So I bought it on iTunes and then started watching it. And it became almost a daily routine, as while I was doing other things, I just had it on. It's strange, and it's wonderful. And it's not great, but it's just one of those things that I can always put on. And it's now added to that very short list I think we all have of films that I just sort of don't mind having on in the background,
mm-hmm.
You know? And with that, we were talking a bit about how more and more now you've got either musicians or bands in their entirety scoring films. You know, we've brought up before, I feel very, very fortunate to see things at film festivals, because what that allows us to do, it spoils you, because you can walk in knowing absolutely nothing about the film you're going to see. And that gives it so much freedom. And it also means that you can discover it as it happens, as opposed to hearing for a month or whatever it may be, you know, such and such is great. Oh, my God, wait till you see. I'm actually seeing the films right now, you know, something like Southpaw. It's been a month of nothing but Southpaw. And I don't doubt that it's a good film. I haven't seen it yet. I don't doubt that it's a good film. But you don't want people to keep telling you how great it is before you even get to see it. It, you know, that's not good. You don't want expectations like that. And where this particularly struck me is when at a film festival we saw The Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
And as I watched this movie, I sat there and I thought, this is a really, really good score. This is a really good score. And as it went on, I just kept thinking that. I kept thinking, this score. I really, really like this score. And of course, did not know at the time that what I was listening to was Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wait, what happened? Who am I listening to? I can't quite believe that this is happening. And it was Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. And they ended up winning an Oscar for it. I am so grateful that I saw it the way that I did. So I wasn't listening for the music. All I knew was that the music was fantastic.
Right. Well, same with the Coen brothers, you know, last film where, again, they called on T-Bone Burnett.
Yeah. When in doubt, I mean, really.
Yes, well, his knowledge is so vast.
Yeah.
So vast. And I wasn't crazy about that film. I thought Oscar Isaac was pretty incredible in it. Playing that
He's talking about Inside Llewyn Davis.
Inside Llewyn Davis, where he plays this self-destructive folk singer from the 60s.
Yeah.
But the score, again, you know, just extraordinary. Chris Thiele and, you know, some of those, the Punch Brothers guys, just wonderful, wonderful music and wonderfully evocative music that works for the film. Doesn't call attention to itself, works in the context of the movie. That's what I like. That's why I liked Begin Again, which Baron and I discussed, the follow-up film from John Carney who made Once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it works. It works. The fact that you may not listen to the song ever again or not be able to hum it as you leave the theater is not the point. It doesn't work in the movie, for the movie. That's what I'm concerned with. And that's how I judge it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a little break because we got lots more to talk about, but we'll take a pause and see you again in just a minute. Folks, we have a new sponsor today. We're grateful to our sponsors. They help this show stay on the air.
Mm-hmm.
So we're welcoming Warby Parker. And they believe that glasses should not cost as much as an iPhone. That's why Warby Parker is creating a new concept in eyewear, contemporary eyeglasses that are extremely affordable and fashion-forward.
Yeah, you see, they believe glasses should be viewed as a fashion accessory, like a bag or a shoe or a necktie or a hat. And at $95, they make it very easy to accessorize with glasses on top of the great price.
And all glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coating at no additional cost.
Oh, interesting. What? Anything else that comes with
that? Oh, yeah, that come with a hard case and a cleaning cloth. You don't have to buy anything else.
Oh, well, you know, I think the best thing of all about Warby Parker is that they make buying high-quality prescription glasses online very easy, risk-free, and most importantly, enjoyable.
Why shouldn't you enjoy the process?
That's true.
Have fun. This is really something. With their home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs of glasses. They're shipped directly to you for free. You can try them all on, get a feel for them, get feedback from your family and friends. 5 pairs. You have 5 days to try them out and then mail back the ones you don't want in a prepaid package.
That sounds fantastic, Malton.
I think so, Vaughn.
Well, thank you. You should go to warbyparker.com/Malton, M-A-L-T-I-N, and choose your 5 free home try-on frames.
Send the frames back, choose your favorites, and order. By visiting that URL, you'll get free 3-day shipping on your final frame choice. Warby Parker makes your experience completely risk-free, and there's free shipping all around. Who doesn't like that?
And just so you know, for every pair of glasses they sell, they distribute a pair of glasses to someone in need.
Good for them. So go to warbyparker.com/Malton today to get started on finding your new look. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Leonard Malton. This is Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. Baron is busy shooting season 2 of Grace and Frankie, and we'll welcome him back soon, I hope. And in his stead, we have my daughter, Jessie Malton.
Double the Malton, double the fun.
Well, we hope so. We'll try.
We'll try.
Jessie and I are both inordinately fond of a wonderful movie called Songcatcher, made by Maggie Greenwald, an extraordinarily talented writer and director. And Songcatcher is a film that couldn't get a break. Its original distributor merged with another distributor. They kind of threw the movie away, in spite of the fact that it won a major award at Sundance, and it stars the great Janet McTeer, one of the finest actresses on the planet, and Pat Carroll, and Emmy Rossum, young Emmy Rossum.
Young Emmy Rossum singing. Yes. You know, now a lot of people know that she was trained as a singer as well. But then they really didn't. And it is such, as movies go, this is, as my dad said, we tout this all the time. Anytime someone says to me, what are some of your favorite lesser knowns or what are your gems, I will yell Songcatcher from the rooftops.
It's about a woman. It's a very feminist movie.
Yeah.
It's about a woman, a very independent-minded teacher in the early part of the 20th century who makes it her mission to go to Appalachia and collect and notate the folk songs, the native songs, the unscripted, you know, unpublished songs of these people who have come, in many cases, from different countries and settled in the South.
She is a doctor of music.
Yes.
Which is something that these folks up in the mountains, not only don't they understand, I mean, she's a woman, which immediately means mm-hmm. they're all going, what are you doing here? And where is your keeper, which is a piece of it, is, yeah. You know, they're going, where's your husband? How are you here right now?
Right.
But then as well, she's outspoken. And she's
headstrong
and very headstrong and very independent. And what has brought her there specifically is that her sister has been teaching in one of the very, very small schools.
Played by Jane Addams.
Yep. Wonderful. Also wonderful. Her sister has been teaching up there and has mentioned all of the music that she's hearing. And so Janet McTeer schleps, and I do mean schleps, all the way up. Finds these people, has to gain their trust,
yep,
and then proceeds to attempt to document,
yep,
these songs.
It's a great story.
These songs that have never been written down, yep, because the whole point of them is that they're passed from person to person.
Yep.
So figuring out that they came from Ireland or Scotland or wherever it is, and it's
along with the dances that often accompany,
yep,
them,
along with dances, and it's just so musically. If you enjoy it, to me, whenever someone says, I love Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I say, you need to see Songcatcher.
Yep.
Because it's the same type of thing, and it's so pure. Janet McTeer, in general, should just win everything.
She's great.
Win everything.
She's an extraordinary actress.
If you saw her in Albert Nobbs, you know, she was nominated, but she didn't really get... She should just win everything. I'm just gonna stick with that. She should win everything. She's a phenomenal lady.
There's so many films. You know, Mike Leigh, one of my favorite filmmakers, the great British filmmaker. You never know what he has up his sleeve. Last year he gave us Mr. Turner, a brilliant film about the great painter, played by Timothy Spall, which not enough people saw. Great film. Well, about a decade before, he decided he wanted to celebrate the life and work of Gilbert and Sullivan. He said, you know, he grew up as a schoolboy. Every schoolboy of his generation knew Gilbert and Sullivan. It's pretty much true here in the States, too. Gilbert and Sullivan were part of the popular repertoire here in America as much as in England. I grew up, my parents played me, you know, the Mikado and the HMS Pinafore and those. And, of course, those songs are so wonderful and so much fun to parody. Comedy shows and variety shows would have fun writing special lyrics to familiar Gilbert and Sullivan tunes. But I think it skipped a generation or two now. And now it's more a specialized thing that certain people know them or certain people have heard of them, but they're not part of the common vernacular. And that's what Mike Leigh wanted to address or redress in his film Topsy Turvy. It's just a spectacular movie. It not only a great biopic, but it's also so evocative of the period and really gives you a context for how and why these wonderful shows and scores were created. Peerless cast and a film I think is really, really, really special. That's a film where I got the CD because I wanted to listen to it again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that often in the age of CDs, in the era of CDs.
Yeah.
I didn't do that often, but I did it for that. I did that with some of Danny Elfman's early scores, too, to make a sharp left turn here.
Yeah.
But Danny Elfman so blew me away when he came on the scene.
Yeah.
Not just with the scores that people, you know, talk about, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and some of the early ones that put him on the map.
For me, it's Beetlejuice,
yeah,
and Edward Scissorhands, right, and Nightmare Before Christmas.
But also Dolores Claiborne. I mean, yep, he's done, yep, so many different kinds of scores. And he took a lot of heat early on because he didn't have the formal training of some traditional film composers. And some of the older guys razzed him a lot, and he as I say, he got raked over the coals more than once, and he worked very closely with orchestrators and with people who could help him realize his ideas.
Yeah. Well, he also, I mean, he came from Oingo Boingo.
Right.
He came from a very popular group, a rock band. So, you know, that too, I think immediately has everyone going, all right, buddy, you think you're some cool kid. And we don't know if we want to let you into this club.
Yeah, well, he's in the club now.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's such an enormous talent. And yet, as identifiable as some of his early scores are, where you can hear them and say, oh, that's Danny Elfman,
mm-hmm,
he's gone past that now. He's way past that now. because he's done so many different kinds of scores that it's clear his talent is broad and limitless.
He also, though, at this point, has done something. There are not very many people who can say this, but he wrote a theme that everybody – and I it's rare that I can say that so comfortably. Everyone knows The Simpsons.
Yeah.
He wrote The Simpsons theme song. Mm-hmm. I defy you to find a place where people don't know that. That was another question actually someone asked you.
About movie themes?
Yeah. What are your favorite movie theme songs? And I actually – in both cases – the ones that I thought of, I thought of because of the experience we had with them.
Well, Henry Mancini, one of the great film composers of all time, as well as a gracious gentleman to boot, wrote, among other things, the Pink Panther theme for the original movie The Pink Panther, Blake Edwards' movie back in 1963. And he wrote it, and when they recorded it, they used the services of a very fine saxophone player named Plaz Johnson, unusual first name, P-L-A-S, Plaz Johnson.
Who, don't ask me how, but actually looks like the Pink Panther. I cannot tell you why, but he does.
And Plaz Johnson has been a major player on the L.A. music and the L.A. jazz scene for many, many years. And over the past, 15 years or so in a number of jazz clubs, I've had the pleasure of hearing him play. Whenever he's a sideman on any gig, he worked a lot with Steve Tyrell, and Steve Tyrell would always make a point of saying, oh, and here's Plaz Johnson. Plaz, tell him who you are. And he'd play four bars of the Pink Panther theme. Well, I had another moment like that, I think the year before last, my friend John Burlingame, who teaches at USC and who writes eloquently and prolifically about film music. He's brilliant on the subject. Wrote a book, which won the Deems Taylor ASCAP Award, in fact, on the music of James Bond. And in conjunction with that, he hosted an evening at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, celebrating the music of James Bond. And how did they open the evening? Well, they opened cold with the film clip on their giant screen from Dr. No, James Bond, Sean Connery, playing Baccarat. And at one point, he gets up and he caught the eye of an attractive woman. They get up together. You think they're maybe going to have an assignation. They're going to leave the room together. And as they're leaving, you start to hear quietly on the soundtrack, bum bada bum 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 bada bum bum, for the first time. First time anybody ever heard that music. And all of a sudden, the screen goes dark. A spotlight goes on the stage at the Academy. And sitting in the corner of the stage is a guitarist named Vic Flick, who played it in 1963. And was playing it again that night and played it straight through. They had an orchestral track they were able to bring in behind him. And he played it on the same guitar. And he's a very genial guy with good stories to tell, all of which you can read in John Burlingame's book, The Music of James Bond. What a wonderful night and what a wonderful moment that was. Talk about serendipity. You know?
I mean, really, to knock your socks off. There's a film that I love, another one that very few people know, and it's called Absolute Beginners.
Oh,
it's
I like that film.
Directed by Julian Temple. Now, a lot of people know his daughter, Juno Temple, because she's working a lot. But it's directed by Julian Temple, came out in 1986. And it is visually unique beyond words.
It's a cutting-edge movie for its time.
It is.
It may not be as impressive today, but in the era of GoPro,
yeah,
you know, maybe.
I've watched it again though, not that long ago, and I have to say, I think this is a caveat that we always sort of throw out, which is you have to take the film you're watching and watch it as it was meant to be watched. You cannot watch something from 1950 and say, why don't they have this type of a camera? Why isn't such and such clearer? Well, no, that wasn't there. Just as we've spoken about how stunts nowadays, everyone just assumes that it is done by computer because for the most part it is. But when you watch an older film and know that really is a guy falling off of a horse or a house or a God knows what, So with a film like this, it's just, it is unique. That's really the only word I can use to describe it. It stars Patsy Kensit, Eddie O'Connell, David Bowie, Sade is in it. It's just this, it envelops you, brings
it's kind
it,
of a mood piece.
Yeah, it brings you into this world. Robbie Coltrane is in it. It's one of these films, and I know, I don't expect everyone to like it. Absolutely not. It is not for everyone. But if you want to watch a movie that, as I say, visually will be unlike anything you've ever seen, and then brings in this music as well, it's just, yeah, it's an experience, mm-hmm. which it's rare to be able to actually hold something up and say, if you watch this, you're going to have an experience. And you do. And it's something else. And David Bowie is just, he relishes every minute of this film, and he's so good to watch. Another British film, though, that my dad actually turned me on to is The Commitments, which came out in 1991.
Love it.
They're doing the show live again in the UK. This is a film where if people have seen it, I have never heard someone tell me they didn't like it. If you've seen it, I mean, you either like it or you love it. I think you have to love it.
By the way, we were going to feature it on the show, Baron and I, and it, when we checked a month or two ago, you couldn't stream it.
It's very hard to get a hold of at the moment.
It's not an easily accessible film, which is a nuisance.
The easiest thing to do is to buy it, which is what I did a while ago. You have to buy it on Amazon or something like that, mm-hmm. and that's how I have the DVD of it. There are so many pieces to this puzzle that make this an incredible film. One of them being that the lead singer of this band, it's about this young guy, Robert Arkins, about this young guy who decides that he's going to start an incredible cover band. He wants to have the best cover band, just knock your socks off cover band. And so in the film, the lead singer is a young guy named Andrew Strong. Now, what many of us didn't know the first time we saw it is that this guy was 15. If you want to hear Try a Little Tenderness and you want to say, hot damn, that's incredible, listen to this 15-year-old boy who looks like a man. He kind of looks like Baby Meatloaf. Sing Try a Little Tenderness. But the whole film is just, it's a lot of people also who never worked again. A lot of people who did didn't go on.
They were cast for this film.
You know, there are folks, actually Glenn Hansard is in it, mm-hmm. Who you know from Once primarily, but also, you know, he's part of the Frames and several other bands. There's some people in it though who have worked steadily. Comini is in it. There's some people who've worked steadily and some people who just fell off the face of the planet.
But it's so beautifully done. It's written by Roddy Doyle, the Irish author,
yep.
who has that black Irish sensibility where this is not necessarily going to be a happily ever after story. That's not his MO.
No.
And that's part of what gives it the spice and the flavor. And it was co-written by the writers I like a lot, Dick Clement and Ian Lefrenet, who we discussed when Baron and I talked about Still Crazy.
Yeah.
They were
which is so
too.
Good.
That'd be a great double feature, actually.
Oh, yeah.
That's a great double feature.
I know what I'm doing tonight with you. that's what I want.
But it's, you know, and if you're of a certain age and you remember some of these R&B and soul songs from the first time around, Otis Redding and some of that other stuff.
But even, frankly, a lot of the songs they use are songs that younger people know because they are played so often.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't know who sings them originally, there are definitely a whole lot of people who don't know who Otis Redding is. Mm-hmm. They are poorer for it, but, you know, that's the case. But the Commitments, there's also, I have to, on YouTube, for the, I believe, I don't know if it was the 10th or the 20th anniversary of it, but they did a lot, they performed. They got everybody together and they performed. It's on YouTube. It is Oh, just one of my favorite things. And as I say, it is they have done it before as a live show, and it is playing now in the UK as a live show again. I can't recommend it enough as just something that will make your heart happy.
I know another film that makes your heart happy, and it's a different kind of musical altogether, drawing on a different kind of musical genre, Connie and Carla.
Love that movie so much.
Talk about it.
Well, Connie and Carla. Connie and Carla, I actually spoke about it a little bit with Barron the other day, because it stars Toni Collette. Barron and I were speaking about...
Oh, that's right.
Yes,
that's right. You did talk about it.
Yep, about actors who... actors and actresses who are not as well-known by name as they should be. Well, Toni Collette, and I spoke about Connie and Carla a bit, but Nia Vardalos wrote this film, and it's... So...
This was in the wake of her great success with My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes. What it's about are these two best friends, played by Nia and Toni, and they witness a murder. It's not giving any, as my dad always says, not giving anything away. They witness a murder and then have to go on the run. They get themselves all the way to Los Angeles, where they realize that... The thing is, they're performers.
They work in Holiday Inn lounges.
They do a lot of dinner theater. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of dinner theater, and they love it. And so they get to Los Angeles and can't help themselves. They want to perform. So they end up pretending to be drag queens. And it goes from there.
Because that gives them access to a stage in West Hollywood.
They can perform without anyone knowing who they are. David Duchovny is in it as well, and is very sweet in it. It's a different role for him.
But it's all Broadway show tunes.
It is show tunes, and let me tell you, if you are not singing along, you are missing out. I put that movie on. I sing to my heart's content. It's another one of the feel good. My dad's not a big fan of The Birdcage. My mother and I know it word for word. I have double featured The Birdcage and Connie and Carla. That's a good night. That is a good time had by all right there. Just glorious.
Well, it's just fun.
It's fun. That's it. It's fun. Not every movie has to be the greatest thing you've ever seen.
No, of course not.
And sometimes you just want to have a good time.
Yeah. Now, dare I talk about this odd film that I happen to like? Dare I do that?
I think you can mention it, but let's not.
No, okay.
You can mention it if you want to.
People ask me about guilty pleasures. I don't feel guilty.
No, you're not guilty. It's just...
But it's a film. Film caught me off guard.
Yeah.
Completely called Repo, the Genetic Opera. And it started as a performance piece in a club or a stage space here in Los Angeles. And then expanded and became a full-scale theatrical piece. And then a guy named Darren Lynn Boozman, who directed Saw 2, a film I chose not to see because I can't watch that kind of film, used his golden ticket for the moment to convince the people at Lionsgate to let him make a movie of this strange horror rock opera called Repo, the Genetic Opera. And he hired Paul Sorvino, who has an operatic voice, to play the megalomaniac main character, a guy named Roti Largo, whose company GeneCo dominates the world in the year 2056 because he supplies new organs for people whose bodies have failed. So it's all about, that's the currency of the day, is organ transplants. And it's partly a horror film, partly a parody of a horror film, partly a faux opera. And Sarah Brightman is in it. Paris Hilton is in it briefly.
Yes.
And it was written by Darren Smith and Terrence Zadunich. I hope I pronounced that right, Terrence. and I just find it so odd and so endearing and appealing. Not everybody did,
Mm-mm.
but I did. Repo, the Genetic Opera.
I'm going to bring up a film you and I saw at a film festival many, many moons ago. We saw it in 2003. It didn't really get much of a release until 2005 and still not known by many people, called The Boys from County Clare.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when it was released, it became The Boys and Girl from County Clare. It stars Colm Meaney and who I adore, and Charlotte Bradley, who's another one that just can do no wrong, and Andrea Corr. And if you're about my age, you might know a band called The Corrs. They're Irish, and they were quite popular for a little while, but didn't really necessarily blow up, and they're not really around too much now. But that was part of the draw of having her. And what this film is about, so I love, if you haven't gathered by now, I love the UK. But beyond that, and my dad and I are the same in this, is I really love interesting folk music. So we talk about Songcatcher, we talk about A Brother, Where Art Thou? I really enjoy music that has a history.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is about is a traditional Celtic folk band that are going to be taking part in a championship, the County Clare's annual All-Ireland Traditional Music Competition. And it's two brothers who basically are always fighting each other. They're battling to win this. And it's a battle that's gone on for many, many moons. And while it is not, I will say, it's not a great film.
But it's a sweet film.
It's a very sweet film. And musically, it's a wonderful film to watch because you get to hear, if you like Celtic music, which I realize not all of you will, but you get to hear some really beautiful music played by people who really know what they're doing, because that's the thing, is they didn't have to cast anybody that you know. So instead it is people who really have just been playing these instruments since they were born.
Yeah. It's a feel-good movie.
It is.
You know, it's contrived. It's not a wildly original piece of storytelling.
Yeah.
But it's very pleasant and very easy to take. Very likable.
Very likable. And again, the music. I will just stand by that. The music.
Yes. Well, great music can elevate any film.
Yep.
Whether it's background music or source music or organic to the film, as the last few instances that we've brought up, where it's really woven into the fabric of the movie. And we like all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we decided we would focus on music primarily today.
We are music loving Maltons.
That be us. And we're glad that you're there listening to us. Thank you so much for doing so. You can always find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin and on Facebook. And most importantly, at my website, where I write about all sorts of things, not just reviewing current movies, but film books, DVDs, film festivals, film events, remembering people who've just passed on. I did a piece about Omar Sharif and my one very memorable encounter with him. Give it a try, leonardmaltin.com.
And again, same as last time, we will be mentioning, my dad will do a post and mention a lot of the films that we've been speaking about. So if you do want to try and catch any of them, granted, some are harder to find than others, you can at least see the list.
And some of you we've found are more resourceful than others.
In
ferreting these out. Good for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks again for listening. We will see you again next time. Take care.
Take care.
This summer.
You sent her, you monster.
The world's greatest screenwriters.
So it appears it is to be a chess match, after all.
And Hollywood's brightest actors.
How do you just stop believing in it all?
Will come together.
Eventually, you will slip.
In a cinematic explosion.
I hope you trip and break your bloody stiff neck.
The likes of which podcasting has never seen.
Whew, end of the goddamn world, huh?
The Blacklist Table Reads takes the best screenplays from the famous Blacklist website and brings them to life with cream-of-the-crop talent and beautiful sound design. It's like a movie for your ears.
You have no idea how committed we are.
The story continues every week with a new movie every month. The Blacklist Table Reads, hosted by me, Franklin Leonard, and not in the movie trailer voice. Check it out on iTunes, at wolfpop.com, or on your favorite podcasting app. We'll see you there.
Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.